Never approach a topic directly, you'll scare it. This is very much that journey bit of a fantasy novel, but they don't decide where they're going to the end of it. It's chaotic wandering.
Yeah, I can't... Well, no, are they not trying to get back to Ankh-Morpork?
They've
kind of been driven by Rincewind's homesickness.
Yeah, but I don't think they agree as a group that's where they're heading until the end of...
That's true, yes. I think quite near the beginning of this section, Rincewind decides he wants to go home. Two Flowers happy to join in, but then the companions they meet have other ideas and...
Yeah, so it's like that bit of the fantasy novel where the group forms.
Yes.
Which, I found really just divert away from Pratchett, but the Sam Sykes book, City Stained Red, starts... It's a really good fantasy book, part of a really good fantasy trilogy, but it does start with a group of heroes already together, with their relationships in place. Going to us, and you sort of get the feeling that
I think I would like that.
Yeah, that not always boring, but can be boring bit of a fantasy novel where our unlikely hero meets a ragtag group of fellows to go on a quest with, and then they travel to a city.
Yeah, I could be well up for skipping that. One of the reasons I really like the Rivers of London series, Ben Aronovich, is that there is, unlike most magic happening in real world books, there is no period of having to convince the protagonist or any of the protagonists that magic really exists. What he's seeing isn't just him going mad. Blah, 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 blah. No, it's like, oh, magic is happening. Fine. Right.
Cool.
I guess I'll deal with that now. Because, it's always my least favourite bit of anything to do with magic is the whole...
Yeah, it's
get going. Let's get going. Come on. Yeah.
You're a wizard, Harry. I'm a what? Right. Okay. Can we skip to where you're at school? And no, you're still surprised by things.
Yeah. But the... Yeah, I realise they're on a journey. But...
A journey.
Let's go on a journey. Oh my God, Joanna.
I'm the worst.
I was actually trying to think whether we could give them a metaphorical journey here. Because I'm sure there's some kind of plot structure. You know, like we were talking about your pyramid and the circle and things like that.
We're in the Norman circly thing.
We're in the trials and tribulation bit, basically, aren't we?
Yes.
So a bunch of irritating shit happens.
Which, to be fair, pretty much sums up Rincewind's life, is things just keep happening to him.
But I think what it does, this bit definitely kind of strengthens the bond between Two Flower and Rincewind.
Yeah.
And introduces Cohen.
Yeah, which I do like. I love a bit of Cohen the Barbarian.
I love a bit of Cohen the Barbarian. And yeah, I think just fleshes out the Discworld a bit more, really, doesn't it?
It does. It reminds me a bit of the Temple of Belshamaroth bit in Colour of Magic.
Oh, that boring.
No, I don't think it's not that dull, because that bit did really drag.
Mm.
But I feel like this is Terry Pratchett improving as a writer from book to book, where he's written here what might have been in the back of his brain with Belshamaroth, and he's kind of, this gets to a bit of, I don't know, ragtag heroes sitting around a fire, little bits, which I do like from classic fantasy, but I'm going to avoid talking about Tolkien too much, because I got in trouble for doing that in a Pratchett group once.
Did you?
I made the mistake of saying in a Terry Pratchett Facebook group that Tolkien was a little bit overrated, and don't do that. Definitely don't do that. But Tolkien's a tiny bit overrated. Just a little bit.
I mean, it depends what you mean by overrated. Do you mean, I would agree if you would say he's not like the finest writer of all time. He's incredibly influential.
Oh yeah,
is why I think it's impossible to overrate how influential he's been on fantasy.
Yeah, but he didn't want to make fiction. I love The Hobbit.
He just wanted to world build forever.
He wanted to make a massive sandbox for I don't know, not even for other people to play in. He wanted to make a big model and it to be a thing he made, and it was there.
But The Hobbit was so good.
The Hobbit is a wonderful, wonderful book that I love deeply because I read it as a child. And The Lord of the Rings are books, that series of books I forced to read myself as a child and will not do again.
Really? Huh. I think I've read it two or three times. But yeah, I mean, compared to
I have reread them as an adult, but... But also, he's super influential. Yes, large amounts of the modern fantasy canon would not exist if it wasn't for him. But at the same time, other fantasy canon might exist because so much modern fantasy is Tolkien inspired.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yes.
Yeah.
And influential, so, but that's not necessarily the best thing.
Yeah, and it made, like, there was a phase of fantasy being super homogenous, and like,
yes.
I mean, that's what
that's what the whole thing is.
That's what these books are taking the piss out of. There are elves, and elves are tall and glamorous, and there are dwarves, and dwarves are short and grumpy.
Yeah, you can basically look at Dungeons and Dragons, and it's that.
Yeah, completely that. And it's really hard to find fantasy that isn't that. That's why I love Saladin Ahmed, Throne of the Crescent Moon, which is another really good fantasy novel that... Have I made you read?
No.
No, that's based on... amazing fantasy book that doesn't base anything on Norse culture or Nordic culture, and he looks at Arabic folklore and creates fantasy from that.
Interesting.
And it's a really good book. Like, just, I highly recommend it. But also, it's amazing to read something based on folklore I'm not automatically familiar with. Or like, as well, yeah. Gentleman Bastards as well, because it is not a heroic novel, and there aren't...
Help me out, what's that?
Scott Lynch, The Lies of Lochlemora.
Oh, I still haven't read that because you told me it's not been finished yet.
Yeah, no,
and
I'm
you've
still
already
sorry
burned
about
me
with the wind.
Pat Rothfuss. Yeah.
But that's another one where it's less Tolkien-esque and it's about confidence tricksters and gangsters. It just happens to be not on our world.
I read... oh, gosh, do you know what? I'm probably not going to talk about this because I will say... I will mash it so badly. I did read a magic school kind of book once that did not fit any of the tropes, and I'll look it up for next month because it was very, very good.
So there is less Tolkienish inspired fantasies around. Trudy Canavan has lots of good stuff. The Magician's Apprentice.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. That's one of my favourite book series. And
did you get me to read that? That's probably yeah.
I'm 90% sure if one of us has read something that the other has also read, one of us would have probably recommended it to the other.
Yeah. Before we launch into this, I have a discovery that I can't believe I didn't discover before.
Yeah.
Which is the Annotated Pratchett Files, which I mentioned briefly before we started recording, and you have seen before.
I'm aware of them.
But it's full of the kind of shit that I love and have been following.
Yeah, the references and the...
Yeah. However, I feel like because of that, despite finding them now, I'm not going to look at them before doing our own show notes and references and things. Do you agree?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, very much so.
Okay. We'll put a link to it in the show notes, and it's fantastic, and it's particularly special because the chappie who's put them together, whose name I've now forgotten, asked for Pratchett's feedback on a lot of the stuff and got it.
Yeah.
And so it's well worth having a look through, but it's one of those things, if I see somebody else's idea about something, it's a lot harder to come up with your own idea, a la Tolkien influencing everyone forever. Follow-up. I just really wanted follow-up as a section. So the homework I kind of set myself was seeing if Ash Kent had a meaning and a reference, because I just feel like every time I see something that could do, it does, but this time it doesn't. The one I picked out really doesn't appear to, unless... it's a reference to Ash, comma, Kent. There's two of those, two villages in England. That seems unbelievably dull for a Pratchett reference, so even if it is, let's pretend it isn't.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't call Kent a village.
Yeah, so as far as I can find through, at least 20 minutes arduous research.
I feel like that's all you should really be putting in.
Yeah.
It's a shame, though, if it had been something, that could have been our obscure reference.
Oh, no, I've got a different one for that.
Oh, have you got an... I'm very excited. I can't wait to get to the end of this podcast. I'm sure our audience feel the same.
Yeah. All right. That's a point. Before we get to the end, we probably better begin it.
And do you want to make a podcast then?
Oh, I suppose we should make a podcast.
Let's make a podcast.
I'm tired. Put the kettle on first.
Yes. Hello and welcome to The Truth Shall Make You Fret, a podcast in which we are reading and recapping every book from Terry Pratchett's Discworld series in chronological order. I'm Joanna Hagen-Young.
And I'm Francine Carroll.
And today is part two of our discussion of The Light Fantastic, which is book two in the Discworld series.
Huzzah!
Two-two!
Two-two!
There are very few ballerinas. Tragically. I'll see if we can arrange some for you next time, dear.
So, yeah.
Note on spoilers.
Oh, note on spoilers. Yes, do the disclaimer, darling.
Yes, note on spoilers. This is a spoiler-heavy discussion for the book The Light Fantastic, obviously. But very spoiler-like for the rest of the series. We'll try and avoid revealing any major plot points for the rest of the books. And no spoilers whatsoever for The Shepherd's Crown, the very last book, because I know there's some people who haven't read it yet.
Yes.
So you can come on this journey with us.
Stop it, Joanna. Metaphorical journeys are never okay.
I know, but it really is. So it's just going to keep happening. Especially as in this book, we go on a journey.
Yes, a physical journey from one place to another place on feet and occasionally horseback, as journeys were meant to be done.
It isn't a real journey, the friends we made along the way.
Absolutely not.
Fine.
It's not the journey, it's the destination. No, wait, the other way around.
It's not the destination. Right, never make tripe for a journey, it's Ronson.
Whoever made up that saying did not have a commute. That's all I'm saying.
Whoever made up that saying liked making fridge magnets for 40-year-old woman named Susan.
Oh, Susan.
Or Karen.
Get better taste. I feel really bad for anyone named Karen, you know?
Yeah, it has become synonymous.
Yeah, also I won't start on it because it has kind of morphed very much into a sexist stereotype.
It has a little bit.
Whereas in any woman who speaks up about anything is called a Karen.
Yeah, that is true. However, I also can't judge in any way, shape or form because I have a tattoo on my leg that is very much considered a meme of something middle-aged women have as a wall decal.
Yeah, we'll let you guess what that is.
Yeah. Answers on a postcard to the usual address.
Were you a bit tired when you wrote this summary in the show notes?
Are you referring to my extra use of the word fuck?
The world's going to end, so the wizards are pulling some fuckery. Grey Tatooine is heading for a big-ass star. Luggage buggers off to find Two Flower.
There is nothing
wrong. You missed an end bracket here.
I feel like that's more of a thing than the vast amounts of profanity in the show notes. I think the wizards are pulling some fuckery is a completely accurate depiction of what takes place.
Actually, you aren't wrong. That is a good use of the word fuckery, which in itself is a good word.
Yeah, I love the word
bit
fuckery.
Of necromancy.
Bit of necromancy?
Bit of necromancy.
Does summoning death count as necromancy?
Ooh, it's either not necromancy or the most necromancy thing you could do.
Exactly, because good question. you're not reanimating a corpse.
No.
But it is death magic, quite literally, in that you are summoning death.
Mm. I suppose it depends what definition of necromancy you want, then. Is it death-related magic, or is it only summoning dead people?
Yeah.
And considering it's not a science that's been pinned down in any...
I mean, I feel like using the word science to refer to necromancy is probably not entirely accurate.
I'm getting in character.
Oh, okay, yes. Well,
who inhabits the disc...
As someone who inhabits the disc, yes, necromancy, definitely a form of science. I'm going to use the argument that summoning death is not necromancy because the professor of necromancy is not there.
Yes, all right. Yes.
And therefore...
It looks a lot like necromancy.
I think it's a bit necromancy-ish. Necromancy-ish.
Yeah. But then it looks a lot like summoning demons does, and that's...
Summoning demons else. Definitely isn't necromancy. Yeah. It's demon summoning. That's its own good thing.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Alright, cool.
What happened in the first part of The Light Fantastic?
Well, Joanna, previously in The Light Fantastic, Rincewind and Two Flower's astral adventure was cut short when the Octavo emitted a chain spell, teleporting them into a magically charged forest. Ambushed by wizards in a gingerbread cottage, our intrepid pair escaped by air pin- by air pinching? Oh, escaped by air. Pinching a witch's old broomstick. Ambushed by wizards. Oh.
I'm sorry.
It's very serious. Ambushed by wizards, our intrepid pair escape by air. Pinching a witch's old broomstick and defenestrating themselves.
Excellent. A+ use of the word defenestration, Francine.
Oh, also, all 8 spells in the Octavo must be spoken together on Hogswot tonight, or the world's going to end, I think.
Yes.
The wizards aren't keen on that, so they're pulling some fuckery, as you quite rightly say. Minus Gilderweatherwax, minus Gilder. Him, because he made a light snack for Two Flowers Luggage at the end of the last section, if you recall.
I do.
Can Rincewind overcome his inability to actually pilot a broomstick? Can Timon fill Gilder's elaborate boots? What's going on with that weird red star? Find out in this week's episode of The Light Fantastic.
I mean, technically it's an episode of The Truth Shall Make You Fret, but...
Installment of The Light Fantastic.
That was excellent and much better than the summary I attempted to write.
So yeah, that's what's gone on so far. Gio, do you want to summarise the section we're meant to be talking about?
Yes. So just to clarify, we're talking about page 69. To page 191 in the Corgi paperback edition of The Light Fantastic.
Okay.
Other editions may vary. I'm very sorry that we can't research it for all of them, but I don't love you enough.
No, but as we did last time, actually, should we just start with the first sentence so people can calibrate?
Yeah. Where's the first sentence?
It is. Oh, no, that's the last sentence. Okay, it is. Rincewind? Rincewind opened his eyes. Not that it helped much. It just meant that instead of seeing nothing but blackness, he saw nothing but whiteness, which, surprisingly, was worse. So, find that, and then come back to us.
Yep. Right. So, what happened in this section? Well, as far as the wizards go, the luggage ate Gilder and escaped the university. He's buggered off to find Two Flower. We find out that there is, in fact, yes, this big red dot in the sky because Great Arturian is heading for some kind of big-ass star.
Good.
Trimon held a meeting and that made us all cringe.
Oh, we did cringe.
Oh, such a cringe. We've all had those meetings.
Yeah.
I don't like those meetings. And we find out that he's sent off a hero to find Rincewind. Meanwhile, Rincewind wakes up on a flying rock with Two Flower and a druid cooking bacon. We discover that druids work with stone circles. We have a brief octavo interlude.
Not as good as an albatross interlude.
No, I think albatross interludes will always be my favourite. Oh, the albatross. Anyway, Rincewind discovers...
Weirdly wistful about a bird you never met, mate.
Look, you don't know. Rincewind finds out that the spell lodged in his mind intentionally because he's good
dick.
At... Yeah. Well, Rincewind's good at surviving.
By he's good at
running
surviving.
Away.
Yes.
We see a classic druid ceremony.
Classic druid ceremony.
Woman always gets sacrificed. Yeah. Two Flower interrupts it with good intentions. Cohen the Barbarian interrupts to fuck shit up.
Classic.
Two Flower gets knocked out. So Cohen introduces Rincewind to the horse tribe and we get a cheeky bit of necromancy.
Ooh.
Cheeky necromancy. Pop over to Death's house. We reunite with the luggage. We escape Death's house and the gang decide to head for Ankh Morpork. And then briefly, the hero sent to find them captures them, keeps them in a troll's mouth. Everyone gets rescued and we end on an announcement for two of our heroes to wed.
Oh.
Lovely.
It's like a little soap opera.
I love it. Do you have a favourite quote from this section?
Yeah, I do. It's actually quite a little sentimental one.
Oh.
My favourite quote, which will then need some context, was... Anyway, I like his eyes, he said. They can see for 50 years.
Oh, that's lovely. I don't even remember reading that one. I missed that.
Oh, so context-wise, it's when Rincewind and Two Flower and Cohen and Bethan are riding along, leaving the necromancy place.
Yes.
En route to troll adventure.
Mm.
And Two Flower is kind of waxing lyrical about Cohen's adventures and telling Bethan about the time they single-handedly defeated the snake warriors of the Witch Lord of Sibelind and stole the sacred diamond from the giant statue of Offler, the crocodile god. Two Flower is fanboying. And Cohen goes, he's got eyes, hasn't he? And he says, yes, but they don't work like other people's. Take it from me. I mean, well, you know the horse people's yurt where we were last night? Yesh. Would you say it was a bit dark and greasy and smelled very like an ill horse? Very accurate description, I'd say. He wouldn't agree. He'd say it was a magnificent barbarian tent hung with the pelts of the grand beasts hunted by the lean-eyed warriors from the edge of civilization and smelt of the rare and curious resins plundered from the caravans as they crossed the trackless... Well, and so on. I mean it, he added. He's mad? Sort of mad, but mad with lots of money. And then Cohen is... listening in on Two Flower telling the legend. and a weird smile formed among the wrinkles of Cohen's face. I could tell him to shut up, if you like, said Rincewind. Would he? No, not really. Oh, let him babble, said Cohen. His hand fell to the handle of his sword, polished smooth by the grip of decades. Anyway, I like his eyes, he said. They can see for 50 years.
Oh, that is lovely.
All right.
No, I like that. I hadn't put that much thought into that, but that's a really, really sweet quote.
Yeah. Usually on Rincewind ones, I would probably try and find like a funny quote, because I do chortle throughout Rincewind. But I must say, in this section of this book, the bits that made me laugh were just little brief exchanges, just funny dialogue.
Yeah, I mean, there is some really funny, like, quippy little chats in this
exactly,
bit.
But nothing that stood out to me like that. What did you pick up?
This is a bit longer. It's a paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
The Death of the Disc was a traditionalist who prided himself on his personal service and spent most of the time being depressed because this was not appreciated. He would point out that no one feared death itself, just pain and separation and oblivion, that it was quite unreasonable to take against someone just because he had empty eye sockets and a quiet pride in his work. He still used a scythe, he'd point out, while the deaths of other worlds had long ago invested in combine harvesters.
Yeah, that's...
I think we're in Death's Domain still at that point.
Right, yes, sorry. So we're really getting the first real introduction to Death then, aren't we?
Yeah, so we talked a bit when we were talking about The Colour of Magic that mm-hmm. we were really excited to see Death, but the Death in that book
yeah.
isn't quite the Death we're excited to see. The character develops.
Yeah.
We're having to reassure first-time readers that actually we really love the Grim Reaper and we have our reasons.
Yeah.
And we start seeing it now. I mean, we... see, you know, Death's whole house, but that's his motivation. And yeah. also I like that thing, you know, people don't fear death, they just fear all of the things around it.
I fear death.
Well, okay, yes, you plan on living forever.
Yeah.
But again, do you fear death or do you fear ending and obliteration? This has got very heavy for a podcast.
Yeah, fuck me. I don't know, I feel like they're one and the same. I see what Pratchett's trying to say here, but I don't see that there's anything to death apart from the ending of life, which is what I'm scared of.
Well, yes. But I just think it's a lovely quote about the fact that there is someone who, when people are dying, takes it very seriously yeah. and treats it with the gravitas it should be treated.
Yeah.
And has not industrialised it.
No, the combine harvester bit, actually, that's picked up again later on in the book called Reaper Man.
Yes.
Which I don't think I mentioned when we were talking about our favourites, and I always forget, but it is quietly...
one of your favourites.
One of my favourites, for sure. Like, definitely top three.
It's one... I'm always struck by how good it is when I reread it, but I don't seek it out to reread very often.
Yeah.
And we'll get onto why when we get to that book.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, that's a good one to look forward to. I'm excited about that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was my favourite quote of the
that's
day.
That's nice, yeah. Yeah, and it's surrounded by, like, the description of Death's Domain for the first time, which we revisit later, but just his garden is well-scythed. Lawn was yes. mentioned, that was cute.
I like the thought that Death does his gardening. I like the thought of him pottering around with a pair of gloves and a little apron.
Yeah, I mean, if basically you stand outside of space and time, you've got time to do the garden properly.
Yeah.
And that is my excuse for why my garden looks so shite.
I do wish I could stand outside of space and time every now and then just to get some bits done.
Yeah, yeah.
Just bits, just little bits.
Yeah, just hoovering. A potter.
Yeah, just a little potter.
Little potter outside of space and time, darling.
Yes, that'd be lovely, darling. Let's make a plan. Let's go for a little potter outside of space and time.
Get some chores done, get some hoovering.
Yeah,
some washing up.
Bit of dusting.
Side the lawn.
Side the lawn, dear. Dear, could you side the lawn? Sorry. France Eden and I seem to have become a middle-aged couple from the 1970s. Very middle class. We've got a bungalow.
And or the wrong dimension.
Possibly that too. I'm not entirely sure which dimension, but it's definitely the 1970s and we definitely live in a bungalow.
I've got a weird aversion to bungalows. I never want to live in a bungalow.
I don't like, because I live in a flat at the moment, and I don't like that my bedroom is on the same floor as my living room. I find it harder to sleep because I'm not going up a flight of stairs to go to sleep.
It is hardwired into us, isn't it? I wonder if I'd grown up in a flat if I'd feel differently.
Yeah, I've always lived in a house.
Yeah, I mean, as a child, I had an actual, like, an attic bedroom, so I was two floors up.
Oh, I couldn't do that.
Yeah.
I can barely bring myself to go up one flight of stairs, to be fair.
That was when I was small and energetic and
Oh God.
Full of vigour and vim and zest and gusto. And
do you remember having energy?
Still coffee, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, I do remember having energy, and I mourn its loss every day.
Yeah. So, we meet some new characters in this section.
No, yes, that's what we do next, isn't it? Characters.
Yes, let's pretend we have actually got some sort of plan.
Well, we've got it's in H2.
It's in H2, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Marvellous. Okay. So we do meet a character called the Bursa.
Is it the same Bursa? I know that the Bursa that pops up in all the wizard books, I know that it's him in sorcery, but I can't imagine it's not him in this one. Like, there's no reason why you wouldn't retcon it in to be him, is there?
Yeah. But so this is another one where it's, especially for first-time readers, this seems like a very minor character, but it'll be a delight to have him turn up. He's one of my favourite little side characters.
Yeah.
Especially when he's floating. Yes. So we meet him. There's not much to say about him until we get to...
No, he's just watching a little bit alarmed as things happen.
Oh, he's just a little bit alarmed. That'll change. He'll get more alarmed.
Get more alarmed than that before he breaks.
Spoilers. Bigger character that we meet in this section is Bethan on page 100.
Yep.
And I think at this point, it might be time for the patriarchy duck. And the reason I'm suggesting that the patriarchy duck comes out here, and I know Pratchett gets better on gender, and I know as soon as the next book, which is called Equal Rights, and it's about women, that he gets better on this. But it is page 100 in this damn book, and this is the first time a woman speaks out loud.
Again, we could have the obvious counter-argument here, which is it is a parody of fantasy.
And women aren't there for speaking, yes.
Yeah. I mean, to drag it back to the area you do not want to drag it in Tolkien, he was the worst for that. One of my favourite books in the world, The Hobbit, doesn't have any women speaking, I believe.
No women speak in The Hobbit.
Yeah. So could one be generous and say that Terry Pratchett did this on purpose, or...?
I mean, yeah, this isn't a massive rant and rave at Terry Pratchett. Like I said, I know he's better than this. He writes brilliant books with brilliant women in. And I know it's not even just a thing of the time, because the following book, like I said, has wicked female characters in it, and we will get to that.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's worth clocking, because I think some people, not because I'm criticising Terry Pratchett, and I do get that this is the genre that he's parodying,
mm-hmm.
but I think if I don't point this out, there are people who will read a book and a woman won't speak for 100 pages and they won't notice.
Yes.
And...
I was definitely one of them the first few times I read this.
Oh, yeah, me too.
It's just what you get used to reading fantasy and even sci-fi.
Yeah, it's not surprising that you go that long without a woman speaking or that there aren't many female characters.
Mm.
But I like pointing it out when it happens, because I am not wired to see it in this sort of book, if that makes sense.
Yeah. No, that does make sense. I think it is worth pointing out. What was I going to say? Something very interesting, I'm sure.
More gender parity in parody fantasy novels.
Yes, definitely that. That doesn't fit on a placard, so work on that.
I hate puns. I'm not... I don't, this is why I don't go to protest. It's entirely because I'm bad at puns and can't come up with a funny sign. I am strongly...
The revolution was stopped by a lack of alliteration.
Yes.
What I was going to say was that Pratchett has an essay on... or I think it was a speech originally, on this kind of thing in a slip of the keyboard, but I think I'll save that for Equal Rights.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
But it was just more relevant,
yeah. Yeah. Just a little thing I wanted to point out here.
Anyway, Bethan as a character, let's not...
I know,
let
I do.
Let the subject overshadow her.
She is brilliant, and I don't know if we do see her again after this book or not.
She's mentioned again. I'm not sure if we see her again.
But she's great. I know it's really tropey, but I do love a absurdly competent while happening to be wearing a long flowing gown type character.
Yeah, it's like the, that Tumblr meme I saw a while ago about how if you gather your skirts as you walk upstairs, you're immediately a hard done by but industrious woman in a Jane Austen novel kind of thing. That character.
Yes, if you carry a laundry basket on your hip, you're automatically a sort of hard done by peasant woman wiping her brow after a long day.
Exactly so. But yeah, no, I also like that trope.
I like aggressively competent. I like that, you know, she's in her gown. And I love the introduction of her being really upset about not being sacrificed because she's wasted her teenage years. She has actions before that, but it's mostly standing there waiting to be sacrificed.
Mm. As one does.
Yeah.
When one is the subject of a sacrificial...
And when you're looking forward to it, because, you know, as far as she's concerned, she's going to be up drinking something out of a silver what's-it.
Yep.
Drinking mead out of a silver bowl.
Nice.
Which sounds great in theory, but in practice, mead isn't very nice.
Silver tarnishes very quickly.
Yeah.
I like... I only had mead once, actually. It was at that goth wedding we went to.
Oh, yeah. Mm. No, it's too sweet for me.
I used to like sweet drinks.
Oh, no, I like everything bitter. Anyway, yeah. So Bethan's great, and she's great in this whole section. I like that she keeps cool head, that she knees Cohen in the back, that she's very practical.
Yes.
I approve greatly of her.
Yes, I do as well. She is... And the fact she's 17. Yeah. I like very much when teenage girls are competent and able to be.
Yeah. A bit of me does sort of...
And I don't think she once in this whole book says, oh, well, I have brothers.
No. Which, oh, I hate that line so much. I hate it so much.
I knew that would make you unhappy. I'm sorry.
Oh, God, it's the worst. I mean, there's a bit of me that does... And I know I sound like I'm just looking for things to complain about. I am not just looking for things to complain about.
You'll never make a book critic.
Okay, I'm going to complain about it. I don't want to be a book critic. I want to be a TV critic. Much more fun. Anyway, yeah, no. It rankles a little bit to have this really... The joke of this character is that she's so confident despite being a 17-year-old virgin who is expecting to just be sacrificed. Like, a little bit of her comedy comes from the fact that she very matter-of-factly fixes Cohen's back.
Yeah. But again, is it not the inversion of the trope?
Oh, it is very much the inversion of the trope, and that's why it's funny.
Mm.
Again, like I said, it just...
Again, it's being rankled at the trope, I think, rather than...
Yes, it's the trope that rankles me, and yes, at least she doesn't say anything about having brothers. But talking about Bethan does bring us to the best character introduction, in my opinion, of this whole
section.
In
my opinion.
in my humble... Humble.
I wish you could see Joanna's posture as she says humble. Good grief. I've never seen you sit up so straight.
Oh, it's ironic because I'm terrible at
all of that yoga, inflating your ego.
I know, but I'm marvellously modest about it. Marvellously modest. Oh, that's fun. I like that.
Mm.
Right, anyway, in my humble opinion.
Mm, so humble.
Excellent character introduction of Cohen the Barbarian.
Yay, one of my favourites.
So happy about this. And I can't remember if I said in my last in the last episode that all of my enthusiasm for Frun was misplaced because I was thinking of Cohen.
Yeah, you did, yeah.
Yeah. But now we get to meet him in the best possible way, which is that he briefly threatens Rincewind with a knife and then jumps in, kills the priest, takes the girl, takes the gold.
Mm-hmm.
Classic heroing.
Classic.
Love a bit of heroing. He's probably the most scantily clad character.
Yes.
Which is nice.
Was he just in a loincloth, leather loincloth?
Yeah, in fact, I have... oh, there we go. The passage marked. No, I don't have the passage marked. Did I lose it? I'm so sorry. Yeah.
All right.
Totally bald head, a beard almost down to his knees, and a pair of matchstick legs on which varicose veins had traced the street map of quite a large city.
Nice.
Despite the snow, he wore nothing more than a studded leather holdall and a pair of boots that could have easily accommodated a second pair of feet.
Holdall?
Well, I'm assuming it's some sort of pouch.
Yes.
I'm assuming it holds all of it.
I rather hope good, it does. I suppose. I feel like that shouldn't have to be specified for pants, but fine.
I mean, I think the implication, and I really, really want you to picture this, Francine, is that the elderly, spry man is in fact wearing a leather thong.
But then it wouldn't be a hold all.
Well, hold majority. Hold a bit. Let the rest swing free.
One buttock swing, do they?
Well, I kind of meant the front more than the back.
Yeah, all right.
The point is that the semi-naked elderly man jumps in, messes things up. We find out that he's got a long history of being a hero, but unfortunately...
Long history.
As Rincewind put it, oh, my granddad. Oh.
Yes.
But I like that. I like that we're seeing, you know, what happens to a hero once he gets past handsome posturing age that Hrun was at.
Yeah, I mean, they die by that point, don't they?
but he doesn't. He's outlived it all. There's a really nice little line. I'm a legend in my own lifetime.
Ooh. Yeah, that is good.
Yep. And I loved that. I just love Cohen.
Yeah, interesting times, I think, we're looking forward to for lots of reasons, but Cohen's involvement is fantastic.
He's brilliant in everywhere he turns up. We get some great stuff. Then we are introduced this area of the disc is now introduced to the concept of dentures,
dentures. Yes, yeah.
Which is very sweet and very lovely, and of course he helps out saving from the trolls, which we like.
We like that.
We like a bit of saving from trolls, and he knows about trolls. He's been around the block a
bit. Well, I must say, saving from trolls after they'd been quite so helpful, and really, it was our ragtag bunch of heroes. But no, it wasn't their fault at all, was it? It was their captor's fault.
It was their captor's fault for tying them up in a troll's mouth. In fact, we'll get into their captor.
Mm.
But
Cohen does a good job.
And in all of that, he finds romance. And while normally age gaps do disgust me, but I like...
Oh, surely not 70-year age gaps, Joanna. Age is just a number. There's nothing wrong with an elderly man in his prime of life marrying a teenage girl. That's just how the world works, you know. Men get more handsome as they age and women don't. Look at George Clooney.
I wish our listeners could see the look on my face right now. So, yeah, Cohen pulls a bit of a Leonardo DiCaprio and hooks up with a teenager.
Well, this is a whole bit of celebrity gossip I've not heard, but frankly, I don't care, so carry on, yes.
Sorry, I live on the internet. I'm pretty sure Leonardo DiCaprio has had a girlfriend that was born in this millennium, and it still offends me that literally anyone was born in this millennium. They're all infants.
You are too young to be an old crotchety lady yet, Joanna.
Look, I've been an old crotchety lady since I was 10. I'm just irked. Just all the time. I'm just quite
default irked.
But yeah, so normally this would gross me out.
Yeah.
In that it's a 70-odd year age gap. But there is something about the way it's written that makes it really not gross.
I think the way it's written that's really not gross is that Cohen at no point expresses his wish to be with Bethan because she is a 17-year-old pretty girl.
No.
He expresses the wish to be with her because she is patient.
And because she's very good at kneeing him in the back in the right way.
Yes. It is not... At no point is Cohen kind of acknowledging the fact he's getting together with a 17-year-old because she's a 17-year-old, you're only as old as the girl you're feeling.
Yeah. And when it's sort of pointed out about the age difference between them, he sort of says a lovely thing about, well, it's dangerous times, we don't know what tomorrow might be, and we'll hope she's strong enough to keep up with me.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. I mean, yeah, it would usually be gross. It's not in this one for a couple of reasons.
I think they're both such charmingly likeable characters. I mean, they're barely on the page in this section, but they're there enough that we form very quick emotional attachments to them.
Yeah, yeah. And they... Yeah, neither of them are gross and sappy about it. They both just seem to be very matter-of-fact about the whole thing.
They're very practical.
Mm.
And I like a practical romance. I feel like more romances should be practical and based on things like knowing how to crack your... A romantic partner who knows how to crack your back properly is an incredibly underrated thing.
In theory, if Jack would cooperate and do yoga, I would be able to teach him how to crack his own back.
No, it's not the same.
No, it's not.
No. You need someone who knows exactly when to just dig an elbow into your spine. I don't give out a lot of romantic advice.
Yeah, so that's probably for the best, my love.
Yes, probably.
So, who's next? Who's next, Joanna?
You're going to make me say it, aren't you?
Yep.
Yeah, thanks. Cool. Right. Theatre training. Let's limber up. We also meet, in this section, Herena the Henna-haired Harridan.
Very nice.
Right, try saying that 5 times quickly. Herena the Henna-haired Harridan. No.
Hold on. Right. We'll cut this, but let me have a go. Herena the Henna-haired Harridan. 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 I'm very good at tongue twisters.
Red lorry, yellow lorry's all funnel foot.
No, I can't do any of the ones with L's in, actually. I say I'm good at tongue twisters, not if it's got an L in.
I'm best at P's and L's.
P's and L's. Sorry, that... Oh, my God, I'm tired. That just went together into P's and L's.
Yes. Do you, not aware of a P's and L.
Mm.
It's an archaic tongue twister.
Anyway, this this red-haired one.
I'm gonna. Do you mind if I read out a bit of her introduction? Just to combat what I've been saying, in that I really like the way he pastiches the trope here, and I'll explain why. So we know that we are meeting a hero. We know Triamond has sent a hero.
Yes.
And the book tells us that this particular hero is a heroine, a redheaded one.
Ooh.
Now, there's a tendency at a point like this to look over one shoulder at the cover artist and start going on at length about leather, thigh boots and naked blades. And I will point out that because the cover artist is pastiching classic 80s fantasy, yes, we're talking about the Josh Kirby here, there is a woman with thigh-high boots, naked blades, beach ball bosoms covered with a scrap of fabric.
Yep.
There is a
Not even leather.
Yep. And brief side tangent, what is with the armour for female characters in fantasy games?
Oh, mate, do you know, I feel at this point that's almost like airplane food in how much it's been covered. I don't know, Joanna. I don't know why people... I don't understand the point of view of the people who care about it either. Like, not like care about keeping it that way.
Oh, yeah.
Are these... If I'm not careful, I'm going to talk about Gamergate, so I need you to stop me.
Right, let's not hit Gamergate. I just want to know why my elf character in Dragon Age Origins needs a bare midriff, and why someone needs to see that when they're playing as a female elf. And if it is there, you want to see a woman with a bare midriff and pointy ears, mate, Google.
Right, yeah, that's basically what I was going to say, but way more rantily.
Yeah. There are ways we can go another time about objectification of women and times and a place, but just let me cover my midriff. There are swords.
Yeah.
Just...
There are people
and
who draw sexy fan art.
Yeah, they can have all the bare midriffs they like.
Yeah.
I've seen some brilliant
people Dragon Age will do custom ones for you for a little bit of money. Like,
yeah, like...
Give an independent artist some money for your wank, don't...
But yes, so... Words like full, round and even pert creep into the narrative until the writer has to go and have a cold shower and a lie down. And so the point is made that although Heron of the Henna-haired Harridan would look would look quite stunning after a good bath, a heavy-duty manicure and the pick of the leather racks in Wu Hun Ling's Oriental Exotica and Martial Aids on Hero Street.
Oh, very good, Joanna.
Yeah, okay, we'll ignore the Wu Hun Ling Oriental Exotica bit. She's currently quite sensibly dressed in light chainmail, soft boots and a short sword. I mean, the boots are leather, but not black. Like this, I like that we introduce a female character and he calls out the trope and he says she is dressed sensibly because she is doing a sensible job.
Yes.
He has learned after the very scantily clad dragon lady in the last book.
Yes.
And this is why I get so frustrated when he had the scantily clad dragon lady in the last book, because it's kind of a... Are you parodying the thing if you are just doing the thing?
I feel like the first book... The first book, in contrast to the second book, is that the first book was just a lot of doing the thing.
Yes.
In all the tropes of it. And this one is all inverting the thing.
Yes.
So that's interesting. Or taking it to a different conclusion. Yeah. Yes. I do see more what you meant now. Yes.
Yeah. I like inverting the trope as a parody rather than just doing the trope turned up a bit. And let's all nudge each other, because yes, that's what you're doing, but you're still doing the thing.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Anyway.
Granted.
But yeah, for all that, she's an impressively competent heroine who sets out to capture our lovely people that we've got.
Yep.
Fails because she ignores advice and ties them up in a giant troll's mouth.
Yes.
And it is a bit frustrating that you get this heroine who is doomed to fail. But that doesn't annoy me because of her gender.
Yeah, I don't know if it would have been more annoying if, like, he'd just made her overconfident, do you know what I mean? Like, I am impossible to please when it comes to protagonists, I really am.
Oh yeah, very much so.
Again, it's not because of gender, anyone, like, unbelievably competent I can't deal with, but also there's just some specific areas of competence that if a protagonist doesn't have, I get cross.
Yeah.
I like my protagonist to be able to lie on demand. I like...
Or at least to be have thought of a lie in advance.
Yeah, yeah, I like them to be able to...
I mean,
at least vaguely understand the subtext of language and things like that. I can't deal with the hopelessly, cheerfully naive protagonist, I think.
I mean, you say that, but we really love Two Flower, who is the hopelessly, cheerfully naive protagonist.
Yes, but if he's not velcroed to Rincewind, very quickly becomes unbearable.
Two Flower is great because he has a foil in Rincewind.
Yeah.
Herrina doesn't have a foil, she's just surrounded by some standard British sidekick number one, yeah. British sidekick number two. They do have names, but they're British sidekick number one.
Yeah, no,
British...
I can't be bothered to open the book and find out.
BS1, BS2. is all she really has in a foil, so I think it's a really good character that I wish we sort of got to see more of.
Mm.
And like, I'd quite happily just have a spin-off series about her dealing with incompetent sidekicks and then going home to see her lovely wife, which is me. What I'm saying,
I knew this was going to happen, Joanna.
Look, I'm sorry, I have a really
stop shipping yourself with all the characters.
I have a really specific type, and it's holding a sword.
How about a scythe?
Segue. To Isabel.
Yay, Isabel. Is it Isabel, not Isabel?
I'm going to say Isabel because I don't want to say Isabel because it makes me sound like a bit of a twat.
All right, yeah, that's fair.
Cool. So while we're in Death's Domain, we meet Death's daughter.
Yay.
Who uses the term daddy.
Which has different connotations these days.
Yeah, let's not talk about that.
No.
It is a silly
Let's not
place.
Go to Twitter. Oh
God, let's not go to Twitter. But yes, we meet Isabel, who wants some friends to hang out with, because, yeah, it must be quite lonely when your adopted father is the Grim Reaper and you've got no mates. And I wonder
he's hanging out with some pretty interesting fellas, though.
Well, he has. He's got war, he's got famine. Yeah, I don't think he's got the one that
the
left...
The other one?
Pestilence.
Yeah.
I was trying to remember which one was the real one and which one was the new one for Good Omens. But
Pollution is the new one.
Pollution is the new one. So, Pestilence, this is nothing to do with the book now, I'm just excited to know a fact, is not one of the original Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. The original Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse were War, Famine, Death, and Conquest.
What?
But this is all kind of conjecture and based on translation and things being translated differently.
How does one accidentally translate pestilence into conquest, I would like to know?
I think it's less pestilence and conquest is that, oh, we need a new one because war and conquest are too similar, based on who's translating it.
Right, okay, so in language A, conquest and war mean very different things, in language B, they do not. I see.
Yeah, so if you think that most of this we're getting from the King James Bible, which... Segue from our segue, basically he had printed so the church could get off his back about the fact that he kept giving titles to his boyfriend because he was hella not straight.
Wow.
Yep, cool. Obscure history.
Can we have like a spin-off podcast about Joe tells me which historical figures were gay?
Yes, okay, definitely.
Excellent.
I mean, I feel like as someone who is not a historian, I am not actually the best person for that. But yep, do it anyway.
Never stopped us talking about anything before.
Anyway, so yeah, so the King James Bible, that's translated by a very conquest-y type country that only gets more so in future centuries. Hello, colonialism.
You sound like you're talking about a TV series again.
Yeah, I know. The point, yeah, so because the UK, for the UK, or, well...
England at the time, yeah.
England at the time. England, Scotland.
Mm.
And I guess we'd subjugated Wales already. For England and Scotland, conquest and war would have very much meant the same thing because most of what England did was conquesting. When it waged war on something.
Yes.
Whereas in other cultures, war and conquest would have potentially been very different things.
Oh, interesting.
But that is more conjecture than like an actual fact if that's why we now understand the Four Horsemen the way we do.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to
Death. Let's try and follow the breadcrumbs back to where we are.
We were with Isabel, who wants to pretty much cut Rincewind's lifeline, so she's got some mates to hang out with because...
Oh, we've all been there. We've all been teenage girls isolated in a cottage in the wrong dimension, only wanting to talk to an inept wizard and a weird tourist for a little while longer.
And a suitcase with lots of dear little legs.
Yes.
But yes, I wonder if we'll see any more of Death's Dimension or this lovely little girl, Isabel. I wonder what will happen there. I can't wait to get to that. Sorry. Right. Sorry to new readers. We'll get there. You'll love it.
It's not a spoiler. It's fine.
It's not a spoiler. I'm just trying not to talk too much about future books when we're talking
God, you
about
love more,
this
don't you?
It's not even my favourite of the Death series. I'm just excited to get to introducing these arcs.
All right, yeah, that's fair. We're nowhere near an arc yet, are we?
We haven't got to a story arc yet.
Yeah,
nowhere near the end of this podcast. So that's all the new characters we meet. So, bits that we liked, things that happened.
Things that happened, things we want to talk about more, possibly quite quickly.
Well, we'll get
Gilmore
there,
Girls style. Should we get some weird looking chili fries to not eat as we...
Yeah, they never eat the food in that programme.
Yeah, also, I'm rewatching from the beginning at the moment, and the speed with which Luke always delivers food to the Gilmore Girls
table... That is not being made fresh from scratch.
Right? I am not eating those chili fries, even if that's something I would eat. That is not a version of it I would eat.
I have strong feelings about things that happen in restaurants in fictional TV programmes.
Oh my god, Suki in the kitchen must drive me mental.
I hate it so much. Why is there just random fresh produce lying around everywhere? Why can
anyone...
She keeps
dipping her fingers in the pan.
She dips her fingers in, people just wander in and out. A chef that accident prone would not have a full-time job still. She literally blew up an oven. She stalked a food critic.
It's Can you blow up an oven?
No, the oven blew up. I just and it didn't really well, it caught fire. I didn't make it catch fire.
Okay.
Right, the point is, Suki from the fucking Gilmore Girls is not a professional chef. And no one writing on that programme has ever been in a kitchen.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Why is there fresh produce just on the why
because Jackson leaves it there.
There's no proper stainless steel counters.
No, but it's a charming inn.
I don't care. The kitchen should still have stainless steel counters.
Yeah.
It's wooden. You can't... Right, okay,
I'm sorry, Joe. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have brought up the Gilmore Girls.
You've got me... my ears have all pricked up. I'm aggressive. My hackles are bare. I've somehow...
Your ears are twisting this way and that.
I've somehow swapped bodies with your dog.
Oh, that makes sense. I thought she was peacefully snoozing more than usual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's because she's actually inhabiting my body. Right, anyway, cool. So, moving on from the Gilmore Girls to Druids. Druids and stone
Pretty
circles.
Smooth segue that time, yeah.
Yeah, no, that was really subtle. I love that. I'm a professional.
As an allegory for computers, you've written down here.
I'm misusing the word allegory again, I think. I know I looked it up when
Isn't
we were
that
doing...
like one of the ancestors of a T-Rex?
No, that's an alligator.
No, it's an Allosaurus. If I'm going to do a bit, you have to be, like, be up on your paleontology, dude.
Look,
an Oh, for God's sake, there. The line that spawned crocodiles and alligators is not the one that did... the other ones. What am I fucking talking about? Tyrannosaurus Rex. Yeah, there's actually a much older...
Oh, right.
Yeah, yeah.
So the Allosaurus didn't spawn alligators?
No.
Right.
Allosaurus used to possibly use its head like a hatchet to cut off its prey or to like attack its prey.
Okay,
because
cool.
Its teeth were quite thin but very sharp. It could open its jaw obscenely wide and its skull could take like a lot of impact. And so paleontologists at the moment think it probably like opened its jaw really wide and hacked at its prey like... Its jaw was a hatchet. How fucking metal is that?
That's so metal.
That's so metal.
I want to be an Allosaurus when I grow up.
Why am I talking about Allosaurus?
Computers. Because I misused the word. Because I misused the word allegory again.
Maybe.
I know we looked it up when we were talking about the colour of magic, but I don't retain information very well.
That's fine.
So stone circles are computers on the disc. Mm-hmm. They are the disc version of computers, mm-hmm. And I found that quite amusing.
It is quite amusing. Do you have a highlighted passage?
I am looking for a highlighted passage. Obviously, I haven't actually used highlighter in a book. I've used a ton of post-its, but I'm not...
But the highlighted colour.
Yes, yeah, so we're on the Flying Stone Circle. It's... He describes himself as a computer hardware consultant.
Yes. And because a computer, of course, is a thing that computes.
Yes.
As a computer used to be a job title, didn't it, before?
Yes, it was someone who processed numbers and things. Yeah. And there's a wonderful thing. It can't be software incompatibility. The Chant of the Trodden Spiral was designed for concentric rings, idiot. Fire it up again and try a simple moon ceremony. All right, nothing's wrong with the stones. It's just that the universe has gone wrong, right?
Yeah.
I like this as an explanation of why Stonehenge is there.
Yes.
But yeah, tech support tropes. Just the idea of...
Why would you say A and not B?
I don't know. I forgot it's an A.
What the fuck? That's like the vocal equivalent of an open bracket and a closed bracket.
Which I have also done in my notes.
Yeah.
Apparently, sneaker.
You're like the physical embodiment of an orphan bracket today, Joanna.
Look, sleep deprivation makes me very bad at ending things. can't wait till we try and finish this episode.
Oh, I think we'll just leave. we'll just leave it. I live here, but we'll just go.
The dog will be all right. The dog can finish the podcast.
But yeah, the kind of taking the piss out of tech support stuff is very funny.
Yeah.
And two,
right, now you're just bullying me.
I don't have a two either, I'm sorry.
Well, my be was the tech support tropes. Like, we both have friends who work in IT and have worked in consulting, and
yeah, we've both informally taken on that role in various other
career jobs for people who want money for the rent.
I miss that.
It just made me giggle. Yeah. It makes me very happy. It's a fun thing to happen. Yeah.
If anyone listening to this hasn't watched the IT Crowd, by the way, well worth it.
Shame about the person.
Oh, do you know what? I do not need to hear about who's problematic right now. Can we go through this another day?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Who made it?
Glinner. Graham Linehan, who's like super transphobic.
Oh, yeah, no, that's fine. We did go through this.
Yeah. Right, we'll skip that bit. I don't want to get into that on the podcast.
Anyway, yeah.
But yeah, the IT Crowd is genuinely a very good example of...
Yeah, and it's aged like. Surprisingly well, considering how...
Well, because they don't really talk about technology. They just talk about people not being able to use technology.
Yeah.
And that's... Well, like the book shows, it's really universal.
Mm.
There were...
Oh, yeah, that's true, yeah. If we're talking about outdated technology.
There probably
were. Nobody's used a moon ceremony in ages. It's all juniper berries now.
Exactly. It makes me very happy.
Yeah, it is very good.
Especially because I feel like this is probably not so much fantasy. It's just historically accurate. I like to think that's what druids were doing with the stone circles back in the day.
I mean, more or less, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
There were. Is this all complete, like, guesses from historians? But I feel like people tell me that
I feel like
stone circles worked out the flavour of the sun that week. Yeah, so... when Rincewind is just discovering the trolls, there's just a throwaway almost line. But there were rocks everywhere. The very bones of the disc were near the surface here. And that to me sounded familiar enough, like calling rocks the bones of the earth or something, that I felt like I'd heard it in a poem. And I couldn't find it if I had. However, while Googling that, I found a book called Bones of the Earth, which is about how people choose... landmarks in their local places.
Oh.
And basically how landmarks become landmarks in local communities, and with a focus kind of on natural ones like rock formations and things like that. All right, which I only found today, so I haven't had time to read it yet, but it sounds quite Pratchett-esque.
Yep,
I will be reading it, and it's by Howard Mansfield, if anybody else would like to have a look.
I do like a bit of natural folklore and the way beliefs build up over...
Yeah.
...rocks.
Yeah, and like why we feel attracted to... this and that and the other, and
yes, no, I'm excited. I might have to borrow that from you when you're done.
Yeah, cool. Oh, no, I'm gonna get it on Kindle because it's like £1 million by that. I mean, £20 paperback. So,
oh, yeah, okay, yeah. Cool. I'll read that anyway. So, yeah, so we do also have two flower sort of accidentally...
What was I gonna write down? I'm holding a notebook.
Further reading on Stonehenge, too.
Thanks.
So as well as before we get to the funniest bits with the stone circles, the druid's trying to explain what he does to Two Flower, and Two Flower introduces him to the concept of almanacs and gives him a bit of culture shock.
Oh, yeah. And Rincewind does not like that, because as he quite correctly says, if a rock is held up by persuasion, you really shouldn't be trying to shake somebody's belief in it.
Very much not. But I like, because almanacs eventually end up turning up regularly in the Discworld.
Yeah, hasn't there been a Discworld almanac published? I don't think I have that.
No, I don't think I have that, but I feel like I should probably get one.
Mm.
Well, at some point, you and I shall learn.
Yeah, look at all these tangential books I found. Oh, that's great, it's English, that's for another one. But I've got the Discworld Companion, the Folklore of the Discworld, I've got Science of the Discworld over there. I've got way more lying around than I thought I had.
Yeah, I love a reference book.
Mm.
And we are using these to make this darling little podcast.
Yes, it is.
Dear little legs.
Oh, it's dear little legs.
I can't stop saying that now. But I'm assuming the almanac uses the zodiac, and we meet the Discworld zodiac.
Yes.
Which I'm really gutted we don't get more of. We do get, like, in later books, every year has a name. So
yeah.
Which I really love that the Discworld Emporium now names every year and does...
Yeah, I know, it gets to carry on.
Yeah.
That's good. Do you know what this year is?
I'm not sure. I think it's something to do with the lobster.
Okay, follow up.
That's a follow up.
What year is it? That seems like a note I'll be able to translate understand easily.
But yeah, so we get the century of the fruit bat and...
Yeah, yeah.
Which is good fun. But in this, with the signs of the disc zodiac, there's 64, including Wesen, the double-headed kangaroo, to Gahuli, the vase of tulips.
Yes.
And I want more of that.
I know, yeah, it is a shame, like... But at the same time, like, Terry Pratchett is not Tolkien. He did not write endless indices.
No, I know.
Why do I keep saying indices? Appendices.
Yes.
He didn't write many indices either.
Bodmas, not his favourite. Bidmas. Sorry, I was helping someone with maths.
Oh, no. But yeah, although I suppose the folklore of the Duskwald and science of the Duskwald.
Which he was involved in.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot that's obviously him.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Mm. Anyway, yeah, there's a little bit about the Zodiac in the Duskwald Companion. Which, yeah, there was a little bit in there that I quite like, just as a little extra bit. It would be more correct to say that there are always 64 signs in the Duskwald Zodiac, but also that these are subject to change without notice. The stars immediately ahead of the Turtle's line of flight change their position only very gradually, as do the ones aft. The ones at right angles, however, may easily alter their relative positions in the lifetime of the average person, so there is a constant need for an updating of the zodiac.
Oh, I like that.
Hmm.
I like that he's put thought into the fact that the turtle is swimming through space and that the stars will change.
Yeah. This does at least mean that astrology on the disc is a dynamic thing and not a repository for some rather unimaginative mythology, but it does rather reduce the science to something along the lines of, look there! No, there! Where I'm pointing! There! Does that look like a crab to you? Ah, too late, you've missed it.
Oh, brilliant. I love that.
Just all these little extra bits everywhere that I'm so glad I can't reread enough times to make it unsurprising.
No, I every time I read it, I spot new little bits that I really like, and it makes me very happy.
Yay.
There's always nice, funny little jokes. Like, I somehow missed the names of the Carrick cards, tarot cards. The importance of washing the hands, the eight of octagrams, the dome of the sky, the pool of night, the four of elephants, the ace of turtles, obviously death. I mean, I don't know tarot well enough to know how well that relates to tarot. Yeah. I feel like there's a lot of swords and knaves.
I feel like that was something you would have been into as a teenager.
I was very into it as a teenager and none of it has stayed in my brain.
Cool.
I had five different tarot decks at one point. I would try and read my own tarot every night.
How did that go?
Not great, but I had to do it. I was all queer teenage girls go through a Wicca phase.
Yeah, we covered that a couple of episodes ago.
We did. There you go. See, manifested with tarot. But yeah. I don't remember it. It's, I'm not going to talk about how long ago it was.
Yeah.
It's like march inexorably towards death.
Inexorably.
Is that the word I mean?
Inexorably?
Possibly. I've only ever seen it written down. I haven't tried saying it out loud before.
Do you know what? I'm not sure I have. Maybe I just corrected you with the wrong pronunciation.
Maybe I'm saying it wrong.
Inexorable. No, I'm pretty sure it's inexorable. I think I heard Bill Bailey say it. Anyway.
Anyway, I'm dying.
Fuck me. yes, no, that was great. The Carrick cards bit. Because it was funny, like the throwaway little importance of washing the hands bit. But then also it said the death card was like bathed in a red light from the...
From the weird little red star and the luggage.
And I just thought that was like satisfyingly creepy as a little throwaway.
I like that all the stuff with the red star builds really slowly and it's not till the final third of the bit that it's suddenly like, oh, wait, no, this is a real problem that's been hinted at throughout the book.
Yeah, yeah.
I like that it suddenly almost becomes the big bad of the book.
Yeah. Huh. It was very cool. Just creepy as well because it's red light.
Yeah, there's a fun little bit in this tarot bit as well, because where Rincewind sort of has a few thoughts about women doing magic that I quite liked. It points out here that the Unseen University has never admitted women because of problems with plumbing.
Yeah.
Why women haven't been admitted to lots of universities, I'm sure. But the real reason was an unspoken dread that if women were allowed to mess around with magic, they'd probably be embarrassingly good at it.
Yes.
I wonder if that subject will come... Yeah, we'll talk about that more when we on to the next bit.
Yes.
But women doing magic. I like it.
Yeah,
it is good. More witches. Wizards and warlocks and all of it.
All of it.
All of it.
All of it. Yeah, the... We'll try and go chronologically this time, I guess. The next one I've got written down is just a little... another writing thing rather than a fantasy.
Oh, yeah, it's a lovely sentence.
Yeah, where have I got it? Here it is. Another voice, dry as tinder, hissed. You would do well to remember where you are. It should be impossible to hiss a sentence with no sibilance in it, but the voice made a very good attempt. Now, I think that might actually, rather than just being a funny throwaway comment, be a comment on something that fantasy authors definitely overdo, which is using the word hissed where it does not belong.
Yep.
And to illustrate my point, I'm going to use Dreyer's English.
Yep.
A fantastic book I recommend to everybody. And Benjamin Dreyer says, if you're seething, exasperated characters must hiss something. And really, must they? Make sure they're hissing something hissable. Take your hands off me, she hissed, from Charles Garbus, Better Than Life, 1891. No, she didn't. You try it. Chestnuts, chestnuts, he hissed. Teeth, teeth, my precious, but we has only six. J.R.R. Tolkien, The Hobbit, 1937. Okay, now we're cooking. I've seen the argument put forth that any sort of strained, constricted whispering qualifies as hissing, to which I can only say that of the approximately 4.3 million ways in which one can characterise speech, hissed is not your best for S-less utterances. Pick another word. Snarled, grumbled, susurrated. Well, maybe not susurrated. And a nice little circle back to Pratchett there.
Circle back to
Pratchett. For the repeat readers.
The word susurrus is a beautiful word to all of us, but especially for those who've got to a certain point.
Mm.
But yeah, no, you do make a really good point. It's not just hissed, though. Like, this is in fantasy books where it's a thing that's like a really crap bit of writing advice that goes around a lot, which is said is dead. Stop using said. You've got to say anything but said. So you
Who the fuck says that? Literally every bit of writing advice I've heard is only use said.
Exactly.
Replied.
Yeah. But no. So you get hissed and snarled and grumbled and shouted and expectorated. A smirk is a smile. It's not a way of speaking.
Yes.
This might be another... This is another one.
Even an adverb on the end of said is possibly... pushing it a bit a lot of the time. If your dialogue should
almost always
be able to put forward its own tone. Thank you. If it can't, then it can't, and use an adverb. Use a different way of saying said, but don't rely on that adverb to
convey tone.
Yeah,
and also if you're reading dialogue, the tags should be. Your brain should almost skip over them because you're reading a conversation.
Yes.
You don't need to make every tag. And
it should be like an end quote.
I used to be really guilty of this. So I found...
teenagers.
But not even just as teenagers. So I write a bit of fiction as well. It's not my... I mean, I write more theatre stuff, so I can't use dialogue tags because it's just someone talking aloud.
Yes.
But I found a bit of fiction I was working on from this zombie apocalypse, Mary Shelley. And
I forgot about that.
The bits of it still exist, but there is an early draft of a conversation between Byron and a prostitute punching him.
Mm.
And I have a different dialogue tag every time because I thought it was more interesting writing.
Yeah.
And then I actually tried reading it aloud to myself and it was awful and I just wanted to punch myself in the face repeatedly for 24 hours.
Yeah, I mean, there's no...
I didn't. I went back and edited it instead.
I mean, that's more productive. Certainly. We're looking for efficiency.
But yes, thank you for pointing that out because it irks me and I like to think that is what he was addressing when he said that.
It's a great book, by the way. Dreyer's English, I'll lend it to you.
Yeah, I keep meaning that's another one you've mentioned to me before.
Yeah, this one and On Writing Well and The Elements of Style are probably the three I would insist any writer reads.
Fair enough.
Or any reader writes.
yeah, and we get to a lovely bit after another one of the Octavo interviews where they're just all sat around talking around a fire.
Yeah.
And Rincewind gets sent off to find onions and they talk about trolls and, I mean, also the fact that we sort of get introduced to trolls here, which get a lot more character development. But I do like the sitting around a fire talking moment. It feels straight out of Tolkien.
It absolutely does, and in a good way.
Yeah.
The
This made me want to reread The Hobbit.
Yeah. And the endless descriptions of food.
Oh, the endless... I love
See,
it.
Everyone complains about that in fantasy. Like, in Revel and The Hobbit are like, no, I love... Like, even the least appetizing foods. Like, if you say it in, like, my tone of voice, then fucking dry bread and lashings of butter and...
Lashings.
Dry bread and some butter and some dried meat doesn't sound amazing. But then you say... Yes, and the bread was stale after a couple of days' walk, but the lashings of butter brought it back to life, and they tore into the dried meat as they chattered around the fire. Like, oh, I'm hungry.
Yeah. It's I love a feast scene. Always give me a feast scene in a fantasy book.
Yeah. Yeah. No, totally agree.
And just lurid descriptions of food.
Lurid.
Lurid.
Oh, butter.
And that's just me as a chef. Butter. Butter. Anyway, sorry, I'll stop rubbing my thighs.
This is why I've insisted on the table this time, Joanna. I don't need to see what you do with your thighs.
Darling. Hurt me. But yes, yeah, so Rincewind does go off on a bit of an onion hunt, and as well as the classic fantasies trope of sort of sitting around here, we meet just in this sort of, I don't know, 50 pages, I'd say, we get a few brilliant moments. We get that, which is straight out of The Hobbit.
Yeah.
We get an introduction to the troll philosophy of time working backwards.
Yeah, that's interesting, actually, because it was just a footnote, wasn't it? A footnote and a sentence. They were talking about a prophecy that's been handed down from mountain to gravel since the sunset of time. Footnote being an interesting metaphor to nocturnal trolls, of course. The dawn of time lies in the future. Which is clearly a thought that kind of Terry Pratchett had, and then it lived in his brain for a bit, and then later on in Reaper Man, it's much expanded upon, as in, alone of all the creatures in the world, trolls believe that all living things go through time backwards. If the past is visible and the future is hidden, they say, then it means you must be facing the wrong way. Everything alive is going through life back to front.
Oh, that's lovely.
It is lovely. I rather like it. I really like what Pratchett does with trolls over the Discworld.
I think it's some of the most interesting development of a fantasy creature. Because trolls don't get a lot.
No, they don't.
Elves have got these massive complicated backstories and dwarves. But you get trolls and individual trolls and humanity, and you see them adjusting to living in a city.
Yeah.
And I mean, I like what he does with species in general in these books.
Yes.
But I think what he does with trolls is one of the more interesting things. And I like that he right from early on, he's creating a philosophy. I also like that we meet a troll called Chrysoprase.
Yes, who comes back later as the head of the troll mafia.
The Breccia. Well, I don't know if it's Breccia. Meant to be that same troll.
It is, I checked.
Oh, it is.
Yes,
it is.
He excused it later on, retconned it later on by saying, well, trolls are bad at spelling.
Yes,
it's spelled with a K here, and a C. So it's Breccia. Not only is it Chrysoprase, it is also
Chrysoprase. I think I'm not saying that right.
Sorry, yeah. No.
There is another troll called Breccia.
Breccia, which is the organisation, and Jasper, his son, the only pebble in the tribe, in this one, is the first troll to be accepted into the Assassin's Guild in Ankh-Morpork.
Lovely, there we go.
So we follow this happy little family through their life of crime.
Which is wonderful. And
legalised murder.
We'll keep an eye out for them in future books. It's lovely. But yeah, so obviously you have this whole thing where they get put into this giant troll's mouth. They set his tongue on fire. Sorry. He rolls around a bit. He's going to kill everyone. And the sun comes up and turned him into stone.
What?
And I have never seen it. Okay, yeah, so that's another Hobbit thing. I was trying to do the voice the way when in the Lord of the Rings films you get the bit where Bilbo's telling the story. I was trying to do the voice.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And the sun came up and turned them all into stone. I really love the Fellowship of the Ring out of those three films. I just like everyone sitting around having a nice time and some fireworks.
Yeah, that is nice.
Yes, and Ian McKellen being charming.
Oh, he's charming.
He's got a very charming
Isn't
face.
Isn't he charming?
Charming bloke.
Yeah, although I must say, in the... although it is pretty much exactly what happened...
As in,
last minute, they turn to stone and the hero is saved.
Yep.
It's not what Pratchett quotes in Folklore of the Discworld when he talks about that scene. Instead, he talks about an Icelandic folk tale in which a troll comes to try and steal a girl's baby brother in the night while the parents are at church at Christmas Eve. And she keeps him talking all night by like complimenting him and singing and all this stuff. And when the family comes home the next morning, there's a huge boulder in the path where once there wasn't. So possibly that was Tolkien's, because it's Icelandic.
Yeah, Tolkien did get most of his inspiration from sort of Nordic and Icelandic folklore, I think. Yeah. Oh, that's nice. Yeah. I like that it's got a folkloric bit that...
Yeah, it's got a cute little like lullaby nursery rhyme thing in it as well, so I encourage people to go and read Folklore of the Discworld for myriad reasons, but that among them.
Yeah, Folklore of the Discworld is probably my favourite of all the companions.
That's gorgeous.
I haven't read all of the science ones, to be fair.
Mm. It's I really like folklore in general. I like picking up kind of either self-published or locally published versions of folklore books wherever I go to a new town.
Yes.
And this, the Folklore of the Discworld is like a bunch of the best ones from it. Kind of.
Yeah, it's great.
It's so good, yeah.
And it's from all over.
Yeah.
But yeah, but I feel like, yes, he's taken inspiration from that tale, but within the book.
Yeah, no, it's very it's Hobbit. Clearly Hobbit, yeah.
It's so people who are really into Tolkien can read and go, ha! He's doing the thing from the thing.
He's doing the thing. He's doing the thing. Do you remember the thing? Do you remember the thing when we said, yeah?
Yeah, it's like that thing.
Although, other than Bilbo, who kind of at least kind of knew what was going on, did he?
Yeah.
Oh, wait, no, I'm trying to remember now. No, it was Gandalf who kept him talking all night.
Yes.
That's right, yes. So it was Gandalf who did that.
We sort of see it through Bilbo's eyes.
That's it. So at least someone was keeping them talking deliberately all night, whereas at this point it was Rincewind, just fucking dumb luck. He was about to get crushed, and luckily the sun gave up, yeah.
He's good at surviving. That's why the eighth spell lodged in his brain.
Yes.
But yes, so from one fantasy trope to another, and this is my... Oh, I just love the mysterious shop.
Sorry. Love you, a mysterious shop.
I should be more coherent. So we get the luggage's origin story, which is, you know, they're standing around chatting, and Two Flower, you know, is talking about the luggage, and basically says, "Oh, I just wanted a traveling trunk, and I went into a shop, and you know, shopkeeper's a little wizened old guy, shop full of strange stuff, and I could find it again." And Cohen just says, "Oh, one of those shops," and shrugs. And do you mind if I read the footnote out for this?
Do.
I love this. "No one knows why, but all the most truly mysterious and magical items are bought from shops that appear, and after a trading life even briefer than a double glazing company, vanish like that hits home. Vanish like smoke. There have been various attempts to explain this, all of which don't fully account for the observed facts. These shops turn up anywhere in the universe, and their immediate non-existence in any particular city can normally be deduced from crowds of people wandering the streets clutching defunct magical items, ornate guarantee cards, and looking very suspiciously at brick walls." And obviously we get to experience one of these shops later in the book.
Yeah.
But A, I like that that is the luggage's origin story, even if, again, I think that gets a bit retconned later on.
Yeah.
Because we meet other bits. We meet more sapient Pearwood.
Yeah.
I just love the use of that particular trope.
If anyone knows this, you will. Has any modern fantasy author, as in writes fantasy set in the modern world, taken that trope and done it like really mundane, like a fucking Argos that vanishes or something like that?
I don't. Someone like must that. Have. Yeah. I haven't read that in a book, but I really hope someone has. And if not, now I want to write a short story about it.
All right, you do that then.
Possibly a play. Ooh.
Monologue. Yeah, monologue, yes.
Somebody works in the shop, cool. Right, sorry, I'm just going to do some brainstorming live on the podcast.
That's fine, I'll carry us.
And you wanted to talk about...
You weren't going to listen to this bit anyway.
You just wanted to talk about how great Rincewind was for a bit as well, didn't you?
Yeah, well, I'm not going to get another chance until, Interesting Times probably next after this?
Well, no, we've got the end of this book.
That's right, we've got the ending to do, yeah.
And we've got Sorcery.
Oh, sorry. Oh, right, yeah. Do you know what, Joanna? Do you know what?
What?
I just don't think we're coping today.
Well, I think we're doing all right.
Yeah? All right. Well, good. I'm easily mollified. That was my last point written down. I've just got a little more evidence of Rincewind being the best, i.e. basically me. a couple of bits about his distrust and ignorance of the countryside. When he is searching for onions, as you... referenced earlier, he thought, although you see them hanging on ropes in the market stalls. They probably don't grow like that. I mean, peasants or whatever use onion hounds or something, or sing songs to attract onions.
Oh, I forgot about that. That's a very good line.
And then a little bit later, the night closed in like velvet. Nice. An owl hooted eerily. At least Rincewind assumed it was an owl. He was a little hazy on ornithology. Perhaps a nightingale hooted? Unless it was a thrush? A bat flitted overhead. He was quite confident about that. It really does... you've been to the countryside with me, Joanna. Does remind me of me quite a lot.
This is very much you in the countryside. We shall never go onion hunting together.
I'm very specifically a small town girl, Joanna.
Yes. Cities, no. Countryside, yes, no.
I'm not taking the midnight train heading anywhere because I know what I likes. Yes. And I likes what I knows. And that does not include knee-deep mud and fucking badgers. I also like Rincewind's not dying.
Yep, I'm
and keenness to continue that going. There's a couple of quotes on that. Owing largely to inefficiency, Rincewind had consistently failed to die at the right time, which is my personal plan for immortality as well.
Yep.
Well, things still tend to work out in the end. Too far saying it. Anyway, I'm a firm believer in reincarnation. What would you like to come back as? I don't want to go, said Rincewind firmly again. That's... basically me. And this isn't me so much, but the calculated madness of when he has a grin at bastard henchman number two.
Yeah.
Sorry, butch henchman, wasn't it? PS2. He grinned at him, and he put a lot of thought into that grin. It was the sort of grin people use when they stare at your left ear and tell you in an urgent tone of voice that they're being spied on by secret agents from the next galaxy.
I mean... I said when we were working on Colour of Magic that you had to convince me a bit on Rincewind.
Mm-hmm.
I'm liking him more as a character now. Obviously, yeah. I love you, but you're not quite...
I'm not taking it as a personal attack, much as I may seem to be.
Well, you were comparing yourself to Rincewind, so I didn't want to immediately follow that up with, well, I think he's a bit of a dick, and therefore...
Well, no, there are a couple of personality traits Rincewind and I share, which is a distrust of the countryside and a particular zest for the lack of death.
Well, yes, no.
But apart from that, I'm not as fond of potatoes as he is. And I personally quite like to see a woman making her own way in the tarot business.
Carrick.
Sorry. Jack Kerouac.
No, let's
is
not
it
talk
spelled
about
like that?
Jack Kerouac. No, that's spelled with a K.
Oh, yes.
And an E. And an R and an O and a U and a...
a lot of vowels. Ginger. Can go
a lot of vowels in Jack Kerouac's name. How did we get here? Right, so yes, no, I'm coming around on
Rincewind. Nightingale hooted.
In Parliament Square. It's not Parliament Square. Berkeley Square. Berkeley Square. God, but sorry.
You're thinking Bill Bailey.
No, the song a nightingale sang in...
Yeah, I know, but he did a parody of it, Midnight in Parliament Square.
Oh, okay. Well, there we go. At least we know where my brain went. I'm coming around on Rincewind as a character.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just still not super into Rincewind stories. I don't find them
as
quite
good.
As compelling.
No, that's fine. That's fine. I can understand that. And literally the only reason I love them as much is the...
They're really funny.
The dialogues are funny quips. It's the little things I love about Rincewind novels. And I totally understand that you don't find the storylines as compelling as, say, the ones with good storylines.
Yes. Well, at least we can agree on that. So, as we said, this section ends with...
As you so rightly said, Joanna.
As I probably correctly said, I've got no idea. We've been recording this episode for 5 years.
As you
years.
So sumptuously suggested.
As I humbly said. Sumptuously.
I've been watching a bit of Fry and Laurie recently.
That explains why you've turned into...
As you so crisply surmised.
Darlings, the end of this section is Cohen and Bethan... announcing their plans to wed. And just so we know where you're at, if we're not using the same editions, don't be offended, but I think we'll go ahead with the wedding anyway. And well, he looked at Bethan and sighed. We'll just have to hope she's strong enough.
Strong enough.
My Cohen accent is not good. So that's where this section ends. Francine.
Hi.
Do you have an obscure reference finial for us?
Oh, I do. In Death's House... as Two Flower tries to take a picture of the clock, the imp complains about the poor lighting and says, about 3 bloody years on F8, I reckon, or something along those lines.
Yep.
And I had no idea what that meant, do you?
Nope, none whatsoever.
Means, Well, it is a photography reference, as one might expect from a camera being.
Yeah, iconograph.
Iconograph, I'm sorry. and it is basically F8 refers to aperture. And aperture is the opening of the lens allowing the light to come in.
Right.
And so the number corresponds to how open the lens is. The higher the number, the smaller the opening. So F8 is reasonably small.
Mm-hmm.
And about 3 bloody years is referencing shutter speed of the camera. And when taking a photograph, the slower your shutter speed, the more light comes in, is allowed in. So if I were taking a picture outside at night, I would have a very slow shutter speed and hopefully a very steady hand.
Right.
Also lends to blur. So basically what the imp is saying is the light's bloody bad in here, as he had said beforehand. So it's no revelation, Joanna, but it is, I hope you will agree, reasonably obscure and thus belongs in our cabinet.
In our obscure reference cabinet.
Our obscure reference cabinet next to the obscure reference finial.
Yes.
I wonder what... Parallel to whatever random item I decide on next week.
Excellent. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
I've learned a lot there. I enjoyed that. Well, I think with that, we're coming to the end of the show.
Oh, God.
I'm sorry.
I mean, I love you dearly, Joanna, and all of that, but I don't think we're long for this world.
No, I don't think so. Unfortunately, I've forgotten what our social media presence is again.
That's all right.
I do this every week.
I'll talk about something else.
Cool.
Yeah, so...
Thank you for listening.
Oh, I did so well there. I did have like a bunch of stuff I loved. Like, as it again, the 8 pages of notes here. The beginning of the universe bit I quite liked. The spells are kind of arguing about how the universe began. It was the Great Egg. No, it was the firmament. If anyone's interested, you're wrong. In the beginning, it was the clearing of the throat. Pardon me, the slime. Distinctly rubbery, I thought. Which was quite amusing, and also I believe a little not foreshadowing exactly, but a little proto wizard argument that
yes.
we will see many times again in some of my favourite books.
I mean,
I do like old men arguing about nothing.
I do. Isn't argument the collective noun for wizards?
I believe so, yes.
Or I feel it should be. Anyway, thank you very much for listening to The Truth Shall Make You Fret. I have been Joanna Hagen-Young.
And I have been Francine Carroll.
If you enjoyed the show, please rate us and review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to get in touch with us, you can on Twitter. We're at Make Ye Fret Pod. You can go to Facebook at The Truth Shall Make Ye Fret. You can email us, thetruthshallmakeyefretpod@gmail.com.
Or if you really want to get in our good books, you can tie a note to the leg of an albatross.
And send it to me.
Yeah.
I love my albatross.
Can I close this show, Joanna, with a little pun?
I believe you can.
During the scene in which everybody is in the priestly ceremony bit, Cohen says the line, "That's priests for you," said the old man wetly. "Nothing but talk, talk, talk."
Marvellous.
Mm.
Beautiful.
Mm.
And on that, dear listeners, don't let us detain you. Don't make me laugh.
I wasn't doing anything.
Getting energy into the room. Energy, Francie. Energy.
It's not my fault. I can't help looking incredulous. It's just my face.
Do something about it.
Resting off putting face.
Roth. All right, Roth.